What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the 440 Guitar Podcast. I'm your host, Jarrell Powell. Thank you so much for tuning up. Be sure to follow the podcast on Instagram at the 440 Guitar Podcast, and you can also listen to it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anchor.fm /440. And if you have any questions or if you know of an artist that you would like to have me speak with them to be a dot connector, if you will, feel free to direct message me on Instagram or go to the 440podcast at gmail.com. So you're more than welcome to do that if you would like to do so. And today I'm very excited. This is a very special episode. I've been watching this guitarist, artist, and YouTuber on his channel for quite some time now, the Fortiboard aficionado, if you will, speaking with him today, Mr. Ryan Burke. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I'm an artist now. I feel like that's being a bit generous. Thank you.
I guess I'll say musician if
close enough. Sure.
Yeah. I kind of had this debate with someone earlier as far as like someone else who sings. It's like, she doesn't consider herself an artist. She sings, and I'm like, I guess I don't know, man. Anyone making the art, you know, making art,
considered artist, but we're all artists, you know. Like, I'm of the position that I think everything is art. So
yeah,
it works.
And then there are those that are like, oh, it's art until you sell it, but that's a whole nother conversation.
It's art, especially if you sell it. In my opinion,
hey, I don't blame you. Yeah,
can sell it, then it's really art if you can make some money off of it.
Right. I mean, someone else likes it. Exactly. That's funny.
Yeah. Exactly.
So how are you, Ryan? How has everything been as far as for just, you know, these crazy 17 months, you know, if luckily people are playing live again and making music and everything? How's everything been on your end?
Oh, I've been busy. And, you know, my side of the industry is marketing, you know, instruments to musicians. And it's one of those things where there's two type of people working through the pandemic. There's the people who are sitting on their hands waiting for work to start again. And then there's the people who are just working nonstop because there's money to be made during this. And that's what I fall underneath. Like, everyone's sitting at home, you know, buying musical equipment, you know, having fun with their hobby. And all the companies are coming to me to do marketing. So it's just been nonstop ever since it started. Like, yeah. So I'm a little bit afraid for it to end. what am I going to do? Like, when people start going outside and stop buying things, like, I'm in trouble.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad it's kind of worked in your favor. I've kind of been on that same spectrum as well, where, you know, luckily I had the opportunity to work from home and everything, when I know a lot of people didn't have that opportunity, where I was like, oh, wow. And then my job title that, you know, of what I do, it's like, yeah, like technically, like the pandemic kind of like helps sustain your job a little more. And I'm like, oh, that's great. It's good to know.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. One more. Great. I know. It's like, hey, one more month, you know, past, you know, don't pay, worry about rent. But, but so here on the 440 Guitar Podcast, really big on origin stories, how people got to where they are today. So just to start off with you, tell me about your earliest memories in music. What were some of your earliest memories when it comes to music?
Man, my earliest memories when it comes to music is, you know, going through my parents' record collection and learning how to use their phonograph. And to me, I was just playing around with, you know, something that was a toy in the house, like putting on records and you know, swapping them in and out and stuff. And we had some kids' records, and we had some, like, you know, records that came from the 70s and stuff like that. So I was swapping between, you know, like listening to like some Big Bird record and then putting on, you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary or something like that. My first experiences like trying to play music is when I was in elementary school. They started putting you into a music program, I think in like third or fourth grade, something like that. And they had a day where they had you come in and try all these instruments and watch someone play each instrument and try to decide like if there was anything there you were interested in. And I was looking at it, I was like, yeah, it'd be fun to learn to play music. And I was looking at the instruments, and I was like, violin looks kind of hard. Mm-hmm. Like everyone seems to be fumbling with that. Like, this other thing looks kind of hard. Oh, trumpet's only got three buttons. I'm going to try trumpet. It's got three buttons. How hard could it be?
I mean, that's a logical, thing, like right. From outside looking in. So that's
right. Funny. Right. And, you know, I learned those three buttons. I actually learned how to sight read music. The problem was I could never get the feel for making my lips work right.
Yeah.
So it's like sitting there fingering all the notes. I had it all memorized. I was sight reading music in fourth grade or whatever, which I can't do now. but I was faking it because I couldn't like get an actual good sound out of the trumpets because I couldn't figure out how to get my lips to do the thing. Maybe I was just like, I had kid lips or something like that. I wasn't ready to do it.
Right.
So I you know, tortured my family for about 6 months of legitimately trying to learn. Like I really dug in and it's like, I enjoyed the parts of it that I was able to do, but I wasn't able to make the main part of it work. And eventually I just walked away. And then I didn't really try to tackle music again until I was in, I must have been 14, something like that. 13, 14. I saw a friend playing a Nirvana song on acoustic guitar. And I was like, well, that looks easy. I can do that. He's just moving this one shape around. I can do that. And so my mom had an acoustic guitar in the closet that had been there since she was in college in the 70s. And I pulled it out. I learned how to tune it. I learned how to play it. And, you know, the rest is history, I guess.
Wow. Wow. That's crazy. I was wondering, too, as far as, you know, the style of music that I feel like a lot of your viewers, you know, tend to hear you play on your YouTube channel. But I guess before getting into that, when it comes to the music kind of played in the house, you know, do you kind of remember what type of music was going around? Was there a lot of like, was there like surferish music around the house or was that something after?
So where that came from with me is that I grew up in a fairly conservative Christian household sort of situation. Mm-hmm. And my mom was really freaked out about new music and new culture and stuff like that, whatever was going on in the 80s and the 90s when I was a kid. But I was always allowed to listen to oldies radio because she knew those songs. She knew what to expect, you know, like everything from, you know, doo-wop up through, you know, like the late 60s would play on the local oldies radio station. And so I grew up listening to that, and I always really got excited when I heard the instrumentals come on, like the classic instrumentals like Walk Don't Run and Pipeline and Apache and stuff like that. And so when I first started playing guitar, like I wanted to learn how to play those. Like those always sounded exciting to me. They always stood out to me as something very different and fun. So yeah, that was an early point of like curiosity for me learning to play guitar. And I really didn't lean hard into it. Like I learned those songs. I learned, you know, what I wanted to play from them pretty early, but then I didn't really lean hard into that until starting like 8 years ago, something like that. Cause I'd done like punk bands. I'd done like kind of like alternative style bands and stuff like that. Like indie sounds and whatnot. And I got to a place in my life where I'm like, I'm a couple of years away from having kids. If I'm going to have a band, this might be my last band for a long time.
Oh, no.
I was thinking in that frame of mind. Yeah. It's like, if I'm going to have one more go of having a band before I turn full dad eventually here. Yeah. Like, what do I really want to do? And it's like, I really want to have a surf band. Mm-hmm. And so I started like diving into the current scene and checking out the newer music that was going around. And I had already been listening to some of the newer music, but I hadn't really checked out the scene. And I started like recording some demos and stuff like that. And eventually I had like three or four songs kind of fleshed out, and I put an ad out on Craigslist, and it took about a year to find three guys that would do a band with me. And so then I was doing a surf band for pretty consistently for about like 4 years, I think. It's tapered off quite a bit. We haven't played in at least 2 years now. But I'm really, really glad that I hunkered down and I did it and I had a surf band, because It's honestly, like, of all the music I've made over the years and been part of making, I think it is the music I'm most proud of. And yes. like the live shows that I'm most proud of playing and stuff like that. And the recordings I'm most proud of listening to and sharing. And so, yeah, like it was an early curiosity for me, an early point of reference for what I wanted to do with guitar. And I'm glad that later in life, I kind of realized that as part of my musical history, I guess.
That's cool. That's really cool. Yeah. I wonder, I was going to ask you, was there anything in particular about surf music that kind of gravitated, you know, because for me, like, you know, I've never really been too keen on surf music. The only thing that always sticks to my brain, and I don't even really think it's constituted as a surf song, is the Pulp Fiction, like.
Surf, that's surf for sure.
Okay, yeah.
Miser Lewis by Dick Dale. I actually learned to play that song before ever hearing it.
Oh, really?
A friend had this tab book when I first started playing guitar. He's like, I got this tab book. I don't really like anything in here. You can borrow it if you want. And what was it called? It's called like classic rock instrumentals or something like that. It wasn't even like a book just for surf stuff, but Miser Lou was in there. And I'm thumbing through this tab book, like trying to figure out like, what can I play in here? What do I know? Then I see these pages of single strings being plucked over and over and over again, the same note over and over, over again for like 15 times and then moving on to the next note. I'm like, oh, that looks fun. I don't know what that is. And I don't know how this tracks timeline. Like I said, I was about 13 or 14. So I was learning to play this song and not really knowing what it sounded like, but like picking up kind of like what the melody is. And then all of a sudden commercials for Pulp Fiction start popping up on TV. I was like, that's the song playing in the book. So that was like a fun moment for me pretty early on.
That's wild. Yeah, like between that and like Wipeout, like obviously, you know, just the obvious surf, you know, surf songs. And it's funny, I never even thought about like, you know, you doing the research on like the current, like current surf, like music, you know, because that just never really occurred to me. You know, I you know, as far as for like all the type of genres, I can only imagine what it sounds like now, you know.
Oh man, it's all over the map. I mean, you've got bands that are doing the very traditional sort of thing, and being very good at it and being very entertaining with it. And then you've got bands that have shot off so far experimental that it's like, how do you even define it at this point? Or they like push in like a full like punk direction or full metal direction. Like there's a lot of like influences being mixed around, but like it's almost hard to define. Like, why is this surf when it's become something so different, you know? But yeah, there's a lot of bands out there, you know, messing around with those sounds, messing around with that mentality towards writing songs. And there's a couple that are successful within the scene, but it's kind of like, you kind of expect if you go down that road, like you're probably never going to be on the radio.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you're like, I have to come to terms with this.
Yeah. You just have to do something for love because it's probably not going to pay the bills for the most part.
Right. I feel like that's so crazy. I feel like that's like almost like half of music genres, you know, because like you don't really hear rock and roll anymore. You don't really hear jazz. You know, obviously, you hear jazz anymore if you're not on a jazz station, you know, so it's just like, you know, obviously you hear hip hop because it's like the most popular genre in the world, but it's just like, it's crazy to think about that. You know, it's like, you know, so it's very interesting.
I think the fun thing with surf, well, I'll chat about that a little bit more and then we can move on to something more interesting, is that it's, you know, it's a style of music, but like as a guitar playing discipline, like those sounds get used in a lot of stuff. And like I think that's why it's worked so well on my YouTube channel, is kind of like exploring those sounds, is because people want to use those sounds, but they don't necessarily want to play a surf song. Or they want to have a part in a song that like kind of references that vibe without writing a surf song. you know, this Surf is great for sampling and stuff too. You hear that happen quite a bit. But yeah, I think there's value to it as like, you know, the same way you could be like, well, I don't want to be a jazz guitarist, but it would be helpful to know three or four jazz chords and work them in from time to time and have a working knowledge enough to like fake it if I want to jam with a friend or something like that. Right. And I think there's, right. you know, kind of value in it in that direction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So kind of transitioning into, you know, your, you know, this YouTube channel, you know, and you kind of being a YouTuber for, you know, music, you know, the 60 Cycle Hum. How did that come to be? How long ago was that when you started it?
Well, we just celebrated our 400th episode of our podcast, which is what it all started at. So that 8 years we've been doing the podcast.
Fred, give you a little bit of applause there.
which is a long time to do anything.
Yes.
But my friend Steve and I, for years, when we were sitting at our office jobs, we would send Craigslist links and eBay links to each other over Instant Messenger and be like, look at this guitar. Like, look what this person's trying to get for this. And just like kind of trading links back and forth and chatting about them. And then right around 2013, 2014, it must have been, we started getting big into podcasts as well. We were listening to podcasts and trading back and forth. Like, oh, what do you listen to? I'm listening to that. And then one day we're like, we've kind of already been podcasting. Mm-hmm. We just haven't been recording it because we had these long conversations about all this gear that we'd find online, all this used stuff. And so we kind of hunkered down, we figured out a name, we figured out kind of like a general idea of what we would do. And we recorded two episodes one night. The first episode, the audio was trash, which happens commonly with new podcasts. Yeah. And then we started to figure it out. We were like, yeah, this feels good. Like, this feels like a fun thing to do. We were, you know, we published it and sent it around to our friends and they were listening. And it just slowly grew from there. And eventually, as it you know, got steam and got rolling, like people in the industry started to listen, like guitar pedal makers and stuff like that. And we started having stuff sent to us and given to us by builders. Like, hey, I love your show. Here's a thing. And at around the same time, I had been transitioning from being a full-time graphic designer to starting to flirt around with doing video production with a buddy of mine. And so I already had all this video equipment around that I was starting to learn how to use. I'm like, if I've got this nagging work ethic. So I'm like, if someone's sending me a pedal, I watch, you know, these YouTube demos and stuff. I should try to do something like that. And it's just another thing that just slowly grew over time. I was doing it mostly for fun and to try to do something extra to connect to the podcast. And then eventually it grew to the point where I was charging money to do demos. And then I started getting enough views on YouTube that it all started to make more sense. And like figuring out all the little, you know, things you have to do to make money to do that sort of thing to make time worthwhile. And at some point, I want to say like 3 or 4 years ago, I had a moment where I was looking at all the time I was spending, not just on the podcast, but on these YouTube videos, because it takes a lot of time to shoot and edit video.
Yeah.
And it's like, you either need to completely stop doing this because you're not making enough money doing it, or you need to go 100% in and invest the time to make it make money. And I thought about that for a couple of weeks. And then one day I woke up and I was like, I'm going to go all in. And I just went all in. I had a few graphic design clients that I still managed here and there, but I just kind of let that side of my income fade away. And I just went all the way in 100% deep. Like I work a business week, like 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. And I just filled that time with producing and filming and editing content and publishing as much as I could. And it took a couple of years, and it was a rough, like financial transition for me, but it took a couple of years and then it worked. Like, I started making my living doing guitar YouTube videos and doing the podcast. And, you know, that's the long and short of it, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you too, because like, it's so crazy how like just like how crazy just people are in general, and especially on the internet where they feel like they have like this this like cloaked cape of like I can judge anyone that I want. And then I know for like strangely, like there's a lot of people that like have said just like really not nice things like I'm like about you and your channel, and I'm just like, what the hell, you know, like. And I think you're such a trooper, like taking like, you know, just kind of like just kind of like dealing with that, like I mean. I guess tell me a little bit about that experience. Is that something that, you know, originally was maybe a little difficult to like kind of push through? Then one day you're like, you know what, these people don't even know who I am. Like, whatever. Like,
no, for me from the get go, 100% my personal outlook on that, on like the troll comments I get and stuff like that. Like you, anyone who does anything on YouTube is going to get nasty comments. It's just going to happen.
Yeah.
I love it. It charges me up. Like it is the highlight of my week when I get a really good troll that'll go back and forth with me and like fight something out with me. You know, I just turned 40 recently. I was a teenager on the early internet in the mid to late 90s. I've done my fair share of trolling. Like I've been that person who's in the comment section being ridiculous, being stupid, trying to aggravate people, you know, have something personal going on in my life and I'm going to take it out on the internet. And so I feel like I kind of understand that person to the point where I'm entertained by it at this point. And it's not disruptive to me. It's not disruptive to my own personal emotional health or anything like that.
Really
the secret of it is, like, I feel like I drifted into this very much as an outsider. I'm not a studio musician. I'm not, you know, some hired gun who's known for amazing guitar chops and stuff like that. I'm decent. I'm functional in a band. I can play in a band. But I'm not a studio musician or a professional musician. And so I went into this like, wouldn't it be funny if I made YouTube videos? Like, I'm not, who am I? Like, what does it matter? Like, why would anyone ever care? And so when people like try to insult me, it's like there's nothing you can say to me that I don't already think about myself but work. Like, I already think I don't really belong doing this. I'm doing it because I really enjoy doing it and I figured out how to make a living doing it, but it doesn't mean that I think I'm a good guitarist, or it doesn't mean that I think I'm, you know, perfect at doing any of this stuff. And as you know, I own my mistakes as much as anyone is willing to point them out. So it's always a little bit funny to me when like people point out the obvious and it's just like, yeah, I know.
Yeah. Is this, yeah, like people have such like this audacity that they can just, you know.
Right. Well, people
say all, you know, this bullshit, you know.
YouTube is still anonymous for the most part. So they feel like they can say anything they want. And they certainly can. And you know, it thankfully it doesn't bother me. I get a kick out of it. You know, that's the good. Other people that I know, they will lose sleep if they get a nasty comment every now and then and stuff. It's invigorating for me.
Yeah. I'm really glad because like I'm just kind of just, like thinking about that and seeing these, I'm like, these fucking asshole people. I was like, these people are terrible. It's like it's almost like you have to have thick skin to do anything publicly because you're just gonna have that person who just, you know, wants to just be nasty for no reason. And part and then the other side of me is like, these people commenting, I'm pretty sure they're not the best guitar. Like, I'm sure they're not session musicians, you know? So it's like, why are we being hypocrites? You know, like
musicians aren't getting onto other people's YouTube channels and razzing them. Like they don't have time. They're being
exactly. They're too busy making money.
Or busy trying to make money. Like they're not thinking about some dude on YouTube who's showing off a pedal and like, oh, let me go see how good this guy is. Like, they don't care. It's the hobbyist, like, which is what I am. You know, I'm a glorified hobbyist, but just sitting at home watching YouTube videos for fun or for information, and they have a hot take on something I did or didn't do or said or didn't say. It's like, that's what it's for. Yeah. It's what it's for, is like this back and forth interaction. I don't think I would be doing YouTube if I didn't have that element of the back and forth with the audience in the comment section. Like that is exciting for me.
That's good. That's great. Yeah. I guess obviously I feel like I would be an injustice to not ask you as far as just like, obviously you've had a lot of videos as far as just like having different Aforda boards and stuff and different pedals put together. I guess just to ask, like, off of the top of your head, because I know you've reviewed so many pedals and played so many pedals, like, what are some of your favorite overdrives that at like a relatively fair price, like just on the top of your head? Because I know for me, just give you an example, because I know there's like a wide range, but like Caline, I have like a couple of their pedals, like the, what is it, the Pure Sky and then the Orange Burst. The Orange Burst like incredibly surprises me. I know it's supposed to be a copy of like a BB, the BB drive or whatever it is, but it's like such a versatile pedal, like super insane. Yeah. And it was like $30, you know what I mean? So, but I'm like, this is ridiculous.
Like Dirty Boost clones.
Mm-hmm.
Like, all really exciting sounding to me. They all have that really loose grit torn speaker sort of sound. And I keep saying every time I find a new Aforda Warder one, I'm like, I need to track down what this is cloning, because I really like this. So yeah, that sort of thing is really exciting to me. The ultimate for me is always still the DOD 250. And I know that they're not technically Aforda board material most of the time, but I bought my first one for $35 off of Craigslist in a Guitar Center parking lot.
Wow.
And the reissues go for $50 sometimes when they're in stock. They're not expensive, but that is like, I'm not a huge overdrive guy, but that is my overdrive. Like, wow. I know that pedal in and out. I know that circuit in and out. I know how to work with it. And so anytime I get a variation of a 250, it's like, yeah, this is home for me. I am not a tube screamer guy. I don't like that sort of vibe. A 250, yeah, that's where I like to live.
Nice.
And a lot of those Dirty Boosts kind of live in that territory, like the BB drives or whatever they're cloning, you know.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, because I feel like DOD is kind of slept on for a lot of, like, I guess, younger musicians. Like, they're like, DOD, what's that, you know?
Well, unfortunately, they barely exist right now. Like, they had a resurgence, they came back strong, and then their parent, the company that owns them is Samsung. Mm. And Samsung was looking through the books and like, what are all these small little like electronics companies we have in here? Just close them down. Mm. And like DOD and Digitech, the new version of them, got shut down with like a strike of a pen on a spreadsheet somewhere. They still make the products, they still distribute them, but all the R&D, all the personnel, all the creative team is all gone. Like, they just completely gutted that whole organization. And I'm sure from Samsung's perspective is like, oh, here's a company that might be pulling in, $1.5 million a year or something like that. And they're like, it's not worth the paper that we print for these reports to keep them going, sort of thing, because they're looking for businesses that do, billions of dollars a year, hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Yeah, I'm sure the profit margins just weren't there for them to keep something like that going. So someone out there, buy DOD from Samsung. Let's
seriously, man, like, come on. Yeah. I just feel like it's funny because I have a video game podcast and it's kind of like a similar conversation where it's like, you expect a certain studio to make like, oh, if they didn't make $1 billion, shut them down. It's like, what are you talking about?
people love the products, but there's some conglomerate that's just like, oh, it doesn't make sense to us, so we're getting rid of it, you know. I will say to anyone listening that buys gear, like, we don't know how long they're going to keep producing the designs they have. So if you want to get DOD at retail prices, I'd do it in the next couple of years. I'm just saying, like, the newer stuff, like, you see a Rubberneck for a good deal, buy a Rubberneck. I think we're going to see those disappear out of the market eventually. And I think people will want to pay for those when they're not available anymore, is what I'll say.
It's good advice. Good advice. I guess one of the last things I wanted to ask you, just to circle back to the guitar, you know, obviously you have a plethora of, of guitars. I guess like, I'll talk about Squire. Cause I find this really interesting. I find just when it comes to Squire guitars now, there's just a really interesting thing that Fender's doing with them. Cause and then also some things that I'm like, like for example, you know, there's a lot, like you have like the classic vibes, which are great guitars, you know, they sound great, but I feel like, the cost of, and it might just be not even a Squire thing, just a guitar industry thing, you know, ever since the pandemic, like those guitars that used to be $100 are now like $189, you know, and then, you know, changing the fretboards and stuff and the necks, like a, cause it's funny. I try to hunt down older, like 1990, 80s Squires where there's like, like a real neck is on there, you know, plywood for a body, you know, but
the early Squires can be amazing.
Yeah, you know, but I guess for you, like you know, tell me about, I guess, as far as like some of those guitars that are around that $100 to $300 price range that just, you know, you enjoy just playing in general, maybe not necessarily gigging with.
Well, I'll say that from what I've observed of Fender over the past 4 years that I've been doing demos and watching the market professionally, stuff like that. What I've seen with them is that they're pushing Squire up to be higher and higher quality and higher dollar value. Mm-hmm. They've basically been replacing the Made in Mexico line, its place in the market with Squire stuff. And they've been pushing Made in Mexico stuff up to being MIA quality, Made in America quality, and Made in America prices. And I'm sure profit margins have something to do with that. But the fact that they've been increasing the quality alongside the price has been really interesting. Mm. But they have left behind like the days where you used to buy a Mexican Strat for $400 new and stuff like that.
Yeah, I never should have sold my Mexican Strat that I had. I was like, God, I feel so stupid, because that was really surprising, like golden age time, where I'm like, this feels amazing, you know, like for the price.
But I will say, I really do think that they've brought up the quality of Squire considerably compared to what Squire was when I was a kid, in those times when Mexican Strats were, you know, $400, $500, stuff like that. Like, yeah, the vintage modified stuff, the classic vibe stuff, even the contemporary Squires and stuff like that. They're really fun guitars. Like, I think they're really fun. And I think a lot of the stigma that a lot of players, especially younger players, they don't care. Like, if it doesn't say Fender on the headstock anymore, they're like, yeah, I got a Squire. Deal with it. Like, I bought a Squire for $399. And then I threw $200 worth of pickups into it, and I, you know, messed with all this hardware. And, you know, people give themselves an education on setting up a guitar with these cheap guitars. And then one day they go, oh, now I want, you know, something nicer. And then they have a more educated opinion on what they want next. But I've seen bands, like I've seen like fellow surf bands playing Squire Jazzmasters and stuff on stage when I know those people have vintage Jazzmasters at home. They're like, yeah, I'm gonna play the Squire. Like, this is a fun guitar. I can take it to a bar. I can kick it around. You know, like, it's kind of wild. I think people have really gotten over the stigma of Squire.
That's a great point. No, I agree, because there's one guitarist that I discovered late, but I'm glad I discovered them. Jack Pearson. You might be familiar with him, but he's like, legendary session guitarist with just amazing guitarist, and he plays Squires all the time. Like, he prefers it. He's like, oh yeah, these are great, you know. And like, he's playing like the most amazing stuff on the fretboard, and like a $200 guitar. And I also think of like Nick Reinhardt, where he was, yeah, you know, trying to hunt down like those Made in Japan Supersonics, and, you know, he has a couple of them, and yeah, played those a lot regularly for a lot of his, you know, his bands and stuff too. So yeah, I agree. I just think that, you know, you know, maybe 10 years ago, people look at your headstock. It's like, oh, you're poor. You don't have a Fender, you know, but now it's like, you know, as long as it sounds good, who cares?
It's like, it's all just a choice now. It's like, if you see someone playing a Squire, you can't assume like, oh, they're poor. You might you kind of assume, oh, that might be a choice, because there's a bunch of really interesting models from Squire, and there's like fun options that come from there, and there's reasons to buy those. Like, it's not looking at someone being like, oh, they bought that because it's all they could afford, and it only came in, you know, two boring colors, and like the pickups sound awful on those. No, they're putting out stuff that sounds and plays and looks good and comes in exciting colors. It's not a compromise anymore. It's a choice that you can make. Yeah. And some people, you know, even people who have plenty of money, I know plenty of people like that who they didn't make a decision. They're like, do I want to have a smaller collection of multi-thousand dollar guitars, or do I want to have 20 guitars? There's a lot of people that are the 20
guitars. That's how I think, man. My wife thinks I'm crazy. She's like, why don't you just buy like your golden, you know, like Strat or whatever for $1,000? I'm like, but there's so many good cheap guitars out there.
And like, you know, it's an amazing time where you can try so many different things with these affordable guitars. And then if you really fall in love with something, and it's like, well, I really fell in love with this. I kind of don't care about four of these things now. I'm going to sell all four, and I'm going to get like a nicer version of the thing that I really fell in love with, and see like, and explore, you know, higher end hardware and higher end parts and stuff like that. And it's just, you know, more fancy experience. Yeah. So you see a lot of, I also see people who, like, it's the same thing with pedals. Like, people who have, you know, pedals that are worth all these hundreds of dollars and guitars that are worth all these thousands of dollars. And they're like, whoa, that budget thing sounds kind of cool. Like, I like the sound of the expensive version. Maybe I'll like the sound of the budget version too. And so I get to witness people going both directions. Someone starting out with cheap stuff and working their way forwards. And someone starting out where they already have a collection of expensive stuff and start working their way back, like exploring the cheap stuff. Like, it's all, you know, at the end of the day, it's all retail therapy, and people just constantly wanting to chase that dopamine rush of getting something new and trying something new. And
yeah,
that's opening package, you know.
That's so true. Yeah, I just feel like there's so many amazing like guitars and just like guitar equipment that isn't mass produced. It isn't like the norm, you know, or the quote unquote norm of like expensive models, where it's just really good instruments that just aren't really widely, you know, sold anymore. Cause like, I've been digging on reverb.com, which is like the most dangerous place to shop for a guitar. Like the Aria Pro, like guitar models, like the older ones, Fernandez. Even like I recently was scoping around like the Laguna guitar series before, like, you know, Laguna went away, but I picked up a Laguna. I think it's like the LE200 or something. It's like $90, but it sounds almost like a $300 guitar. Like, really just wild stuff, man. It's hard to ignore that, where it's like, there's so much good stuff that people are just like, no one knows what this is, I want to get rid of it. And you're like, this is a great value, you know? So I'm kind of that crazy mind as well. But one of the last things I wanted to ask you, I guess as far as just like, you know, I think you probably are answered this already, but I guess just like anyone that's like getting into music today, and, you know, wanting to kind of like explore like maybe like guitars or maybe pedals, or just like not even sure where to start, or just like things to keep them motivated. Like, what would you say to that person? Like, whether it be, say, someone who's watching your YouTube channel for the first time, like what type of advice would you give them?
Who wants to get started from zero?
Yeah.
Like new gear sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Guitar YouTubers beat this to death, but like, honestly, like I can recommend to any new player, just get a Boss Katana 50 for your first amp. But just do it. Like, don't shop around. Just do it. Boss Katana 50 as your first amp. It'll it's 1,000 times better than any amp that I started out with. Like it's perfect. It is perfect for that person. It can play really quiet. You can also gig with it. If you have a group of friends that have, you know, want to do a band thing, you can do it with a Boss Katana 50. You can go play with a drummer, but you can also set it to bedroom levels. You can plug it into your computer and it's full of pedals. It's just full of it. Like, it has this pedals that comes with stock on its face, or the effects that are built in, but you can go into the software and there's so many options in there. It's an education. And they're like $230 or something like that. It's a full education in various pedals and different styles of effects and different things that you can do when you get into the software. And it'll let you know, it'll help you figure out what you like, what style overdrive you like, what style distortion or fuzz you like, what styles of delays and reverbs and modulations that you like. Other than that, like, get yourself a cable, like a 10-foot, 15-foot cable, and find a guitar that feels good to you and looks cool. Like, it has to look cool and it has to feel good. Like, those are the rules for your first guitar. Like, all the other details don't matter. You'll figure that out after your first guitar.
Right.
Like, right. Get the one that's a cool color. It's your first guitar. You want a cool color. Get it. You want to feel happy when you pick it up, and when you look at it, you want to feel committed to it. You know,
I love it. Well, Ryan Burke, it's been great having you on the show, man. Thank you so much, and congratulations to all your success as well. You know, thanks so much for being on the show, man.
Thanks for having me.
Of course,
I always love doing these sorts of things.
Awesome. I'm glad. Well, there you have it, folks. This is Jarrell Powell here in the 440 Guitar Podcast. We'll jam again soon and have a great day. Put you together, so you will.